Ted Jacobson at the University of Maryland, and was an undergraduate at St. John's College, which means that it's possible that he has read more of Newton's Principia in the original than most people in the room, and possibly, I mean, yeah, well, and same with, certainly more Lucretius, I would guess. Anyway, so.
Were you also there?
I was there for a short time. I was an undergraduate.
Newton actually has a habit of only half proving his propositions to keep people who aren't good enough at math from following it. He was upset that his book about atoms had been critically commented on by people he thought had no business in science. Alright, so what I'm going to talk about today is negative energy and the generalized second law. And it's based on this paper, which I posted to the archive this year. Here's what I'm going to do. First, so there's been a lot of interest in the average full energy condition. But there's some people who have shown that what we really ought to be interested in is what's called, what I call the achronal average null energy condition. So I'm going to motivate that and explain what that is. Then I'm going to define the generalized second law, which is something that everyone thinks they know what is, but there's actually a lot of issues you have to clarify before it can be a well-defined statement. Then I'm going to prove the achronal average null energy condition from the GSL, and that's the main point of that paper. And then, if we have time, we'll take gravitational fluctuations into account, thus going beyond the semi-classical limit. Okay. So the first question is why we would like to believe in something like the average null energy condition. Is this going to turn? So here's why. Here's a sort of motivating scenario. Suppose we have an arbitrary ability to create negative energies. Then we're also going to be able to violate the generalized second law. The reason is, we can just take some of this, send an ingoing, sinister, pink, negative energy in here, and it will cause the black hole to shrink with time. Here we see the black hole with its horizon generators. And that makes the area go down, and if the amount of negative energy is unlimited, then that means since it goes down without any amount of associated increase in the outside entropy, that means that the total amount of entropy of the situation is going down, which is a violation. But there do exist negative energies in quantum field theory, the most important one in this context being the Hawking radiation itself, which is outgoing radiation that carries in a negative energy flux across the horizon, but it's associated with outgoing entropy. So this is a sign that there's some deep connection between energy and entropy here, and we're going to need some sort of energy condition in order to understand the why black hole thermodynamics works. You can create all sorts of negative energy, too, if you have mirrors that begin to accelerate. Davey showed that, or squeeze states. It's all over the place. There's even theorems saying that you can never construct a quantum field theory without these things. So the average null energy condition. Suppose we have a null geodesic. That's right here. Actually, I don't think my microphone's on, but I also don't think I need it. Is anyone having difficulty hearing me? Okay. How's this? Yeah. Okay. So, so this is a null geodesic that's infinitely long. So you see here we have some negative energy falling across, but we also have it balanced out by positive energy, and the null energy condition, the average null energy condition, the null energy condition would be this without the integral. So this is the null energy, K is along this direction. It says when we integrate over the whole geodesic, it has to be positive. You can worry about what this does when this integral, when this oscillates out to infinity. I think Borges looked at that, but I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to assume this integral is finite. So this has been proven for free scalar theories in any dimension. It's been proven for free electromagnetism in four dimensions, and it's been proven for every theory with a mass gap in two dimensions.
You mean it's been proven in flat space? Or
in flat space. So this is just Minkowski space. And actually, if you go to curved space times, it's generally not true. So this is why we have to modify this idea of the annex.
So when you say TAB, you mean expectation value?
Yeah, so and you can renormalize it too, obviously. If you think about, so you can define the expectation value of the point, even though you can't define the operator as a distribution. Mm-hmm. I guess if it holds, normally if an expectation value equation holds in all states, it should also hold as an operator equation. Mm-hmm. But there might be some subtleties here with the fact that it's only integrated over in one direction. So here's some counterexamples to the ANAC. Suppose we compactify a direction, and we take our null geodesic. This is just a picture of space, no time, just at one time. And we're going round and round and round in the compactified direction. Now the Casimir effect can cause there to be negative energy densities here, and it's completely uniform, and by going round and round and round, we never leave the region with negative energy density, so we just keep accumulating more and more negative energy, and it's violated. This is in contrast to the Casimir effect, the ordinary Casimir effect between conducting plates, because then if you want to get the negative null energy, you also have to pass through the plates, which presumably have positive energy. Another example is in a black hole setting. You can, if you look at the Bouvier state, so you've removed all the Hawking quanta from the state, and you take any null geodesic at all in this space-time, it's going to violate the average null energy condition because it's going to have negative energy everywhere. Now, this is not a regular state at the horizon, but that shouldn't matter as long as our null geodesic just goes around the black hole and doesn't actually cross the horizon, because you should be able to find a regular state with the same properties farther out. So there's this and other examples convince people it can't hold in general, but they all have something in common, which is that these null geodesics are coronal. So I'm going to explain what that is now. A coronal geodesic is one where you have a time-like curve connecting some two of its points. So if this is our null geodesic and this is a time-like curve, then that means that this is a coronal geodesic. It looks ridiculous in the flat two-dimensional projection like this. But actually, it's very generally happens when you have more than one plus one dimensions, because you can think of all the light rays going through as being in a race. And as long as if you have a light ray coming along, but then another light ray going in a different direction manages to outrace it, then it's and get to the same place faster, then that means that you'll have, in general, time-like curves. It'll be coronal. So these are sort of An apronal one is one that this doesn't happen, so it's the sort of fastest possible light curve going between the start and the finish. So Graham and Olam proposed that if you just restrict to these achronal geodesics, they're also complete, so not finite size, and these are called null lines when it's both complete and achronal, that should obey the ANAC for when you're doing the semi-classical state self-consistently, meaning you're taking into account the energy, gravitational effects of the energy of the field itself. So now this is what I want to show is the case. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm confused about the Bohr state.
Yes.
So if I have just an outgoing null geodesic, is that, so that's just a Schwarzschild.
So an outgoing one isn't going to be, in Schwarzschild, isn't going to be complete, but it's going to violate the, basically any null geodesic in Bohr is going to have a negative null energy everywhere.
Right, because you've taken out the vacuum, so the energy density
is negative. So that one is not only going to be, so I think he was just looking at the ones outside the black hole horizon itself, though.
No. So your theorem is going to exclude the Bohr state?
It's not going to, almost all of these things, yeah, so if you look at the Bohr state, there are no null lines that do not pass through a part that isn't regular. So you could take, on an eternal black hole horizon, you could have, if this is an eternal black hole, then because of the, if you put it in, say, the Emmerich state or the Bohr state, this is going to be have negative energy all along its course. Certainly in the Emmerich state because of the Hawking radiation, but the Emmerich state is not regular on the horizon here. So what you don't have is an infinitely long null geodesic. It only has a finite affine parameter.
Oh, complete has to be complete on
in both directions. That's right. So this is actually, you can violate the average null energy condition if it's only complete in one direction. This is an example of this. Does that answer the question?
I think so.
So,
okay.
So in the Bohr state again, if I just have a null ray though that starts at asymptotic infinity, goes down, scatters off the black hole, and heads out
like the one I've drawn.
Yeah.
This one takes an orbit around and then leaves. Then that will be coronal.
Why is it coronal?
Because it's delayed by the black hole. Essentially, I can just, if I'm a time-like observer, I can just wait here and wait for it to go around and catch up with it by a shorter path.
But if I moved it out more to an asymptotic region, so it's just scattering, like, does it have to make this orbit? Or?
No, this is a particularly extreme
right.
Hit. But
right.
Even if it bends a little, it's coronal.
It is.
Right. This is, I'll get to that later.
Okay.
It has to do with the fact that the black hole has positive energy. Actually, I'll get to it right here. So there's several pathologies that require, generically speaking, for us to have these null lines. So if we can prove the ANAC for these cases, we'll be able to restrict them. For example, suppose you have a traversable wormhole. Then as you go from, and let's take all of these examples to be asymptotically Minkowski. If you have a traversable wormhole, there always has to be a fastest possible light ray that goes from the one asymptotic region to the other asymptotic region. And because it's fastest possible, that means there's no way for a time-like observer to catch up, which means it's a null one. Or traversable, oops, this went weird. That's supposed to be an error on that thing. I know what happened. When you have a closed time-like curve, it's also the case that you can always find a sort of fastest possible light ray going through fastest possible sort of closed light-light curve that's also a null line. And most relevant to your question, anytime you have a negative ADM mass, so let's suppose we have something going through a mass and we consider instead a detour where we go around it. So generally speaking, anytime you have positive energies, the light rays are going to be delayed when they pass through the mass. If you have a negative ADM mass, it would be enhanced. It would go faster. So in the case of a positive mass, this wouldn't be a null line. But in the case of a negative mass, there would have to be at least one null line, because asymptotically you can just go large distances and see that the less you detour, the faster you're going. So you can show by that, with a careful argument, that there exists at least one fastest possible path that's faster than the ones at infinity. That was shown by Penrose, Sorkin, and Woolgar. So in all these three cases, you have a null line. But if you have a generic situation and it obeys the Anach, you also have a focusing theorem that says because the average amount of null energy is positive, if you think of this as being part of a causal surface, the generators of that causal surface have to be focused, and that means there's conjugate points. And if there's conjugate points, then that contradicts the assumption that it's the fastest possible light ray, because that means there's other light rays that go from the same initial to final points that are focused in. So that's a contradiction. And if all of these things can occur, they can occur generically. So what that means is that we can prove the achiral Anach, that we can say there are no traversable wormholes, there are no negative ADM masses, so positive energy theorem for semi-classical gravity, and there's no closed time-like curves. So I think you'll mostly agree, maybe some of you fantasizing about traversable wormholes. But mostly these are things that we would not like to see. So it's good that they're ruled out. So now I turn to the GSL, which is what I'm going to use to prove this. So what does the GSL really say? So here we have the formula for the GSL. The change with time of the Bekenstein-Hocking area term.
Sorry, can you say a little? You said that there's closed time like curves, you can prove the existence of one of these.
Right, so that's in Graham and Olin.
Okay.
These other two cases. And I'm not completely familiar with the argument regarding closed time like curves. It's intuitively obvious for me for traversable wormholes, but.
The claim is you've got a closed null,
right?
A line that goes on forever because it just keeps repeating, going
right. Yeah.
And it's achiral.
Yes, that's the claim.
Okay.
You'll have to look there for the details. Where did the formula go? There it is. I don't know what that. Okay, so the GSL says the change with time of something proportional to the area, plus the outside entropy, evaluated on a horizon, has to be greater than or equal to zero. Now, practically every one of those things I just said has ambiguities that need to be resolved in deciding what we actually mean by this, and different people have taken different opinions. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill this in with content and basically provide you with my own opinions about what this should mean. So first of all, this is called black hole thermodynamics, but it's not actually just about black holes. It ought to really apply in terms of the people who looked at Gedanken experiments and seen that it seems to apply. Some of these diagrams turned out weird on this, but it's just some of the lines are hard to see. But anytime you have the boundary of the past of an observer that is infinite to the future. So the observer is born and then lives forever. The horizon, the boundary of the past of that observer is a causal horizon, and it looks like, from some Gedanken experiments, so it hasn't been proven fully, that that those horizons should satisfy the generalized second law. And this is not true for all causal surfaces, that they're the boundary of the past of an observer who lives forever. For example, if an observer dies at a certain point, then the area is decreasing even classically. And because this is decreasing classically and this can only increase quantumly, and this has an h-bar in the denominator, you can make a scaling argument to show that the GSL is always violated in that case. So that's what I mean by the horizon. Now what do we mean by time evolution? Well, to talk about the area and entropy outside, we need to take a spatial slice that crosses the horizon.
Your observer is not necessarily a geodesic, is that right?
That's right.
So is there any limitation on
the limitation?
Acceleration, any timeline?
Yeah, any timeline, world line that lasts is infinite in proper time to the future. And actually, by continuity, that actually means it has to be true for null geodesics as well. I'm going to use that back. So we have a slice here, and we evaluate the entropy outside the horizon on that slice, and we evaluate the area on the cross section of that slice. And then we can ask, how does this cross, if we change this cross section, what happens? And you might say, well, maybe the GSL is only true for sort of rigid changes where you evolve everything forward in time at the same time. I think we really want a more local statement than that. So my suggestion is that the GSL should be true for an arbitrarily wiggly change of this time slice, as long as the second time slice is everywhere to the future or present of the first time slice. So that's what I mean by time evolution. By the outside entropy, I would like to mean the von Neumann entropy given by the usual formula, except this quantity is actually ill-defined due to the divergent quantum fields very close to the boundary, because the event horizon is perfectly sharp, at least semi-classically, and we have quantum fields at arbitrarily short wavelengths, which contribute a divergent entanglement entropy. So I'm working out a way to try to normalize this for my paper trying to prove the generalized second law for Rindler horizons that I'm partway writing. But for now, for this purpose, we're just going to pretend that we have a well-defined renormalization scheme and just go on applying this in the absence of one. Then I'm going to come back and argue that the renormalization scheme only has to have some very reasonable properties for what I'm going to tell you to still be true. the area term up here. So the von Neumann entropy defined like this is a C number. It takes rho and the output's just one number. It's not an operator. So in order to make sense of this, we really want the area to be a C number as well. So the simplest thing we can do is take the expectation value of the area, because if quantum fields affect the area, where its area is really going to have fluctuations in it. This was argued by Sorkin and Sudarsky with some particular examples showing that it could all work out, and this has many advantages. The first is we don't have to worry about area fluctuations. That some people say, well, if we're really looking at the GSO on short timescales, we should worry about the fact that the area entropy fluctuates, it might temporarily go down, isn't that what happens in thermodynamics? Well, by just dealing with the expectation value of the area, we sort of protect ourselves from that and allow us to just say that we expect the entropy to go up.
So you're talking about the quantum theory of gravity, not semi-classical.
This has true even, well...
Because I mean, I don't understand what you mean, right? If gravity is classical, then area is just...
Right, so I'm talking about, we're close to the semi-classical approximation here. Actually, this ties into the second point. In the semi-classical limit, you set the curvature equal to the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. But because of this, to prove the GSL, we don't actually need to make that assumption necessarily. We don't need to make that assumption necessarily. We can take the expectation value of both sides of the Einstein equation. And because we've done both sides, at least if we can still use a sort of linearized approximation, the change in the expectation value of the area will be related to the expectation value of the right side of this term. And the result of that will be that we don't actually need this. Now, this is actually a huge plus for justifying the analysis, because really the semi-classical Einstein equation is only really justified when you have a large number of species. Or you can argue about some other cases, but this is a much more generally true equation.
So how do we compute the site and site?
How is this an advantage? We don't know how to calculate.
You calculate which thing?
Right-hand side of that.
Right. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a small perturbation to a background, and we're going to calculate this from quantum field theory, and then we're just going to set that equal. Now that I've argued about what I mean by the GSL, I want to convince you that if the GSL is true, which says that the generalized entropy of future causal horizons can't decrease, and we have CPT symmetry, of which P, C and P are irrelevant to the GSL, we can take the CPT reverse of the GSL, which says that the generalized entropy of past causal horizons cannot increase. So if you believe in the GSL and you believe in CPT, you should believe in this sort of statement. Now, you're probably all going to object to this because somebody's going to say, isn't the whole point of the second law of thermodynamics that it only applies in one direction? And it doesn't apply the other direction. In standard thermodynamics, you say, well, not every state obeys the second law. Instead, you put low entropy initial conditions, and then it has to increase, but that means it doesn't increase in the opposite direction. Now, you have to do that in the case of the ordinary second law, because that's a time, because there's time symmetry in the situation. But the GSL is actually a time asymmetric statement. It's talking about future causal horizons, So it's actually perfectly consistent to have a second law apply to future causal horizons and an anti-second law apply to past causal horizons. And the reason this might work is because, and when taking the von Neumann entropy of the quantum fields, the only form of coarse graining we need to apply here is the restriction to outside of the horizon. So if we have no horizon at all, then actually the entropy of the system will remain exactly the same as time passes due to unitarity, so both the second law and the anti-second law are satisfied. Because the only coarse graining is this restriction to outside the horizon, therefore, we might be able to prove a second law without needing any form of special initial conditions. Yes?
So then this is only applicable to real event horizons, not timelines?
Yes, so this is, so I argued a few slides ago that it should be the boundary of the past of a infinite world one, which amounted to specifying real horizon.
But earlier you said you wanted something a little more local, but if I need to know the boundary of the past and the future, that's
right.
Everything's going to happen. So.
Right. I'm trying to make it as local as possible, but I'm not trying to persuade you that what I just told you is a local statement. I would really like to have a local statement from which the GSL follows. I have some ideas there, but so far it hasn't worked out for me. I'm just trying to make it as local as possible.
But it's not fully local.
It's not fully local, I agree. So this, the sort of arguments I just made are basically similar to the argument for this objective coarse graining by the horizon that was made by Raphael here. And what this means, this is actually an important point because it tells us no one really knows how to prove the regular second law. Because once you start digging into it, there's all sorts of horrible subtleties about what sort of coarse graining am I using, what is the conditions really. And what this means, if this works, is that actually we can prove the generalized second law without having to worry about any of those subtleties. So since no one really understands the ordinary second law, I think that's a good thing. So, now that I've hopefully persuaded you that the GSL and the anti-GSL implies the anti-GSL, we're going to use them both to get the achromal average null energy condition semi-classically.
So are we now assuming that this observer is infinite both to the past and the future? Or do you have a separate?
So it's separate observers.
You
so
have
any,
one for the past.
Yeah, so any future observer observes the GSL, any past observer observes the anti-GSL. And if you have one and the same observer, there's two horizons, and one applies to one horizon and the other applies to the other. All right? So, we're going to set up a gravitational perturbation theory. The actual details are in my paper, but the rough outline is we're going to do an expansion in h-bar. So really the dimensionless quantity here is something like h-bar g times g divided by the characteristic wavelengths of the quantum excitations, which is dimensionless. So we can actually choose to think of this either as an h-bar or a g expansion. But I'm going to choose h-bar here and set the other things to 1. We'll expand the metric out, and it has a zeroth order and a half order and the first order perturbation and then higher orders. We have our background, which has the null line. We have our quantum field theory state on that background. And then the stress energy tensor of that quantum field theory state is going to lead to a perturbed space-time. And we only care about the perturbed space-time for purposes of the area. So the zeroth order metric is just a classical background metric with a null line. And we're going to assume it obeys the null curvature condition that is generated by classical stress energy tensor obeying the null energy condition. Because usually you only need the average null energy condition once you bring in quantum fields, though you can write down fields that don't obey the null energy condition classical. Half order at h bar to the 1/2, that's the size of the gravitational fluctuations. Because the energy is something like the square of the amplitude of the gravity wave, and it's the energy that is h bar omega. So and we're going to ignore that semi-classically. And then if I have time, I'm going to try to show how we can begin to fix that. Then we have the first order metric that comes from the gravitational effects of these quantum fields. Yes?
So this is really an expansion in 1 over the number of non-species.
If you want to justify ignoring this half order, yes. It would involve that. Because in general,
that's an actual dimensionless quantity that doesn't involve restricting to wavelengths that are large in some units. So.
Well, I also need to do that.
You need both.
I need both. But I'm going to show how. This is just my first step. I can remove this with a few caveats.
So the statement is that there's a cutoff in the quantum field theory.
Wait, where did I say that?
Because
there may be, but
because you're assuming that you're neglecting modes of the quantum field that are sufficiently short wavelength.
Right, right. So
there's a cutoff.
Right. So I'm. You could say the order of limits is important here. First, I'm taking a semi-classical limit in which these things go away, and that's sort of the cutoff. And then I'm looking in that limit at a quantum field very strict. Yes. So I agree. So we're going to start just by looking at this. Now, on the classical background, we have the null geodesic, and it itself has a past and future horizon, which you could think of as the past and future horizons of accelerating observers that just accelerate and asymptotically approach the null line either to the past or to the future. So because of that, because it's achronal, it has to lie on both its past and its future horizons. There's a theorem by Galloway that says because this background satisfies the null energy condition, and we also need a form of cosmic censorship here, the past and future horizons coincide with each other everywhere, not just on this null line, and they're also stationary, so there's no expansion or shear. Because there's no expansion, that means we don't have to worry about a classical increase of the area. The increase of the area will come at the next order in H bar. Yes.
So the space-time itself is stationary or static, or
the space-time itself does not have to be stationary as long as the horizon is stationary. So I could have a non-stationary perturbation as long as it was localized outside.
So that's input into the problem or into the theorem that past and future are stationary?
No, that's a conclusion.
So the claim is what? The claim is if I have a generic time-dependent space-time with no symmetries, that if I have an achronal, what you call the null line?
A null line, yes.
That it's it sits inside a 2+1-dimensional surface, which has constant area.
Well, it's a null surface, so I know.
2+1-dimensional null surface.
Yeah.
Which has constant area cross sections.
That's right.
Even if the space-time itself is dynamic.
That's right.
So that means does that mean the generic space-time has no such null line?
That's right.
Condition that space-time has such null lines, does it imply that space-time is stationary or stationary?
Not everywhere, but it is not generic. Now, this includes a lot of, this non-generic thing includes a lot of important spacetimes, like, you know, de Sitter, anti-de Sitter, Minkowski, black holes, you know, Ed Schwartz, Kerr, ABS, whatever.
Those
but,
are all static.
But it is not, yeah, those
stationary.
Are
stationary.
Right, those are stationary. You could perturb those by, you know, spherical shells or something. But you could say, well, how is this in, generally applicable result? Given that the background is non-generic, and my answer to that question is that I'm only assuming the background has this property. The background is non-generic, but the perturbation can be generic. So because the perturbation is generic, all we're essentially demanding not that the real state be non-generic, but that it just be close enough to non-generics.
So if I had to give some propaganda for doing that, I would say something about thermodynamics is about equilibrium, and equilibrium implies some notion of stationarity.
You could say that.
Yeah, that would justify
right.
The non-generic.
But I would also argue that the reason why we originally want this is to prove that every if we prove that every null line satisfies these properties, then we actually get a whole bunch of amazing theorems out of that that don't depend on whether the how non-generic this is. Actually, the way it works is that essentially in spacetimes which violate these things like negative energies, there's null lines generically. But in spacetimes which satisfy it, there's null lines only non-generically.
So
yes.
Just so that theorem of Galloway says that if n is achromal, that latter state follows. The one at the bottom, past and future horizons. Are
that's right.
Okay, but it also says a form of cosmic.
That's right.
What
form of cosmic censorship? It's what Penrose called the slightly weaker, extra strong cosmic censorship. And what it basically says is that there's no singularities on the horizon itself.
So cosmic censorship is necessary, but not necessarily cosmic censorship.
Yeah, it's not the standard thing, which is standardly called cosmic censorship, but I think it's actually more likely to be true than the standard one. So, but it's strictly mathematically, I think, neither weaker nor stronger, but independent. All right. So this is the classical background. Now we perturb it. What happens now? The horizons, the past and future horizons, now still exist, usually, subject to caveats you'll see in my paper. But now they're separated from each other. So now the past horizon and the future horizon, there's a small gap. And that small gap is going to affect the area term here, because now these can now have different areas from each other being in different places. So this is an h-bar first order perturbation. So that can affect the area term because there's also an h-bar in the denominator here, making this whole thing zero order. On the other hand, for this outside entropy term, and for the stress energy of the quantum fields, these will be calculated only on the background manifold. Because this doesn't have an h-bar in the denominator. So that means that the only thing we need to worry about this perturbation for is to get the difference in the area. Everything else is a quantum field theory in curved space-time situation. Okay? Now, here's a causal diagram of my proof. We have the null line here.
How do you identify in the perturbed spacetime which curves define these two horizons?
That's an extremely good question. So the what I'm, so if we have some sort of perturbation here that's sort of quasi-localized, then in general, there's a gauge symmetry that prevents us from identifying the points of the unperturbed and perturbed space-times, except up to h-bar. However, because these accelerating observers still exist, if I assume the perturbation dies away sufficiently quickly asymptotically, then we can say that the future horizon is defined by going way up here, looking to find the stationary, where the horizon is stationary, and then tracing that down back to the past. Whereas this one is defined by going down here, looking to see where the past horizon is stationary, and then extending it up there. And that's why they end up separating. Now, in some cases, such as the Rimbler horizon, there's actually an ambiguity, and there's more than one horizon you could pick that's nearby, but it doesn't wind up affecting the first.
So you're using some sort of quasi-localization of the perturbation?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. So here's the null line. Here's its boundary of its past. So this is what we're taking the entropy of for the GSL. Here's the boundary of its future. And in general, we could also have a third other region besides that. We can't, these two regions, the past and the future, can't overlap, however, because then this wouldn't be achromal. So what we have is we have a spatial slice. We're going to evolve it a little bit forwards in time to here, and it's going to cross the horizon here. And then, because this is a slice that's being pushed forwards, the GSL has to hold on this side, and the anti-GSL has to hold on this side. So the GSL is a statement that the entropy plus the area here is greater than or equal to the entropy plus the area here. Whereas the anti-GSL is the statement that the entropy plus the area here has to be greater than or equal to the entropy plus the area here, which I've written, well, with a minus sign and switching the order like this. You can subtract the anti-GSL from the GSL, and then you can get rid of the entropy terms using a property of the entropy called the weak monotonicity, which says that here that S1 plus S4 is greater than or equal to S2 plus S3. So the two bigger ones have to be bigger than the two smaller ones. Weak monotonicity follows from strong subadditivity, its more famous cousin. And intuitively speaking, what it's saying is that all the information flowing across this horizon here, if it's entangled more than it could possibly be classically with the system here, then that reduces the amount by which it can be entangled with the other side. It's a sort of, so a most egregious possible violation of this would be sort of something maximally entangled with two different systems, which is impossible. So that's sort of an intuitive justification for this. So you use that to get rid of the entropy parts, and then you just have the statement that A2 minus A1 is greater than or equal to A4 minus A3.
So I don't understand this. So why? What's the difference between left hand side and right hand side?
This and this.
Yeah.
The proof is symmetric under switching inverting space and time.
I'm a little confused. No, if the areas were zero, it says one is less than two, and four is less than three. So how do you get one plus four is bigger than two and three? Maybe I'm not seeing.
One plus four.
We'll turn off all the areas.
This is the entropy part.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, these three to here is just algebra.
Oh, you're inputting. Okay.
Yeah, these are my three inputs, and this is my conclusion. And what it's saying is that the rate by which the area is increasing here the future horizon must be its expansion, it must be expanding faster than the past horizon is expanding, which we can write infinitesimally in terms of the expansion parameter theta. So theta of the future horizon is greater than or equal to theta of the past horizon.
Can you explain more of these weak women?
So it follows from strong subadditivity.
Which means?
Which says that the if you have the entropy of two overlapping systems, that the entropy of system A plus the entropy of system B is greater than or equal to the entropy of their union plus the entropy of their intersection.
So here, which are the two systems?
So which are the two systems here?
So that's strong subadditivity. So what we're doing is we have this region here, 3, and we have this horizon in place here, and then we have this region here, which is 2. So we sort of have 3 different systems, and then this one is just the union of this and this by unitarity, and this one is just the union of that and that by unitarity.
When you say strong subadditivity, do you have to introduce the contribution from Blackboard or area term?
This is just the property of the entropy itself.
Yeah, but I know. You can show it, but now you're talking about incorporating gravity effect or.
Right, but as I said, the outside entropy is calculated only on the classical background. So I don't need to justify this any more than in quantum field theory. Now, it might actually be tricky to justify it in quantum field theory because it really requires a renormalization scheme, which I already told you I was brushing over. But
yeah, and the renormalization scheme here is very important on the horizon scheme for horizon. Otherwise, well, as you said, formal entropy in unitary evolution doesn't have a whole lot of
Sorry, say that again?
The formal entropy, as I said, doesn't evolve at all in the unitary, if you assume unitary evolution.
If you believe in the unitary hypothesis, that would be true about full quantum gravity, but it would not be appropriate in this regime.
Yeah.
In which case, the semi-classical regime would have to be via some sort of coarse grain. So from the fact that the future horizon is expanding faster than the past horizon, we can just integrate the linearized Rajaduri equation, substituting in the Einstein equation to get the convergence of the focusing of the light rays in terms of the null energy. And we impose the boundary conditions for the horizons, the ones where I said the future horizon was stationary to the future, and the past horizon is stationary to the past. And you just get that the future theta is equal to the integral from, so this point x, you can contract all this down to, this is just the point at which we're looking at theta. From the x to infinity integral of the null energy is just theta future. And the integral from minus infinity to x is minus the expansion of the past. So this equation is actually the annex. All right, so that's the proof. Now I want to say just a brief word about what's missing here. So what are the limitations of what I just did? First of all, I ignored the renormalization.
So, if we agree with everything you've done so far, it means that you cannot violate ANAC in the space-times where they exist, basically, it's a chronal curve.
That's right.
But you can violate it in any other space-time.
On a chronal null geodesic. That's right.
Or chronal.
That's right.
Okay.
And it is violated.
Okay.
Not always, but often. So we're ignoring the renormalization of the outside entropy. I discussed this in my paper. I say, rather than giving a renormalization scheme, I'll argue that sort of, there's almost certainly going to exist one that works. Because all we need out of our renormalization scheme, other than that, of course, the generalized second law holds, because that's the assumption of this, all we need is that the regulated states satisfy weak monotonicity. But that's a very general feature of quantum systems. So as long as our regulator is approximating it with some sort of finite quantum system, we should be okay. Unless it's like Pauli-Villars or something that has sort of negative, or there's some regulators in quantum field theory that have negative norm states. I think that might be a problem. But as long as you don't, we don't care about keeping Lorentz symmetry, for example. So there's almost certainly some regulator that will do the trick. And the divergences of the outside entropy have to be associated with the connected components of the boundaries and equal on both sides. Because I ended up basically in the proof, subtracting the entropy on one side of the boundary from the entropy on the other side. So those seem very mild assumptions. So I'm pretty sure that you can renormalize this proof. I've also been assuming the Einstein equation, so I have just minimal coupling to Einstein gravity. If you don't have that, then the Wall-Nutter charge tells you that there have to be extra terms added to the horizon entropy, and I strongly suspect that extra terms also have to be added to the average null energy condition, or it's no longer true. I think you see that just by doing, say, a scale transformation of Einstein's theory. And gravitational fluctuations are neglected. But these can be really important, except in the large N limit. Suppose we have a black hole and it's hawking radiating gravitons. We can't stop it from doing that. And that's going to provide an effective energy flux across the horizon. Now, we started a bit late, so it's the choice of the audience whether you want to hear about that or proceed directly to the conclusion.
It's up to you.
Let's hear about it.
Okay. What happens when the gravitons are included? Now, so here's Wright-Jaduri's equation, the thing that I was using the linearized version of. We've also got the expansion squared and the shear squared in it. The shear tensor gives the rate at which a little disk of the horizon deforms into an ellipsoid as time passes.
So you had to ignore those first two terms?
So I was neglecting these first two terms. However, if you quantize gravitons, sigma is going to be of order h bar to the 1/2. So sigma squared is order h bar, and we need to include it, since this is order h bar and this is order h bar. We can still neglect theta, because theta can be obtained from this equation itself. You can see that theta is of order h bar, so theta squared is h bar squared. So we have to include that in that. And there's an important subtlety here. Once we do a quantized gravitons, this shear squared term can be negative. This was shown by Candelas and Sciama in the 70s. And it's just the general property of the fact that gravitons, like any other field, can have negative sort of, this is sort of in some weird way, gravitational null energy, which, because you remember, gravitons don't contribute to the stress energy tensor in GR. So that means that the focusing theorem that was used to prove all the nice results I showed earlier about positive energy, no traversable wormholes, etc., don't apply. Because the convergence of the null rays is given not only by the null energy, but also by the shear squared. So if this is negative, it can lead to defocusing. So that means that all those theorems only apply in the strict semi-classical limits with large N, not when you quantize gravitons. Unless we fix it by proving that this whole integral, including both terms, has to be greater than zero in generic states.
Sorry, but here you're still assuming Einstein field equations to be true?
Yes.
So then why you don't expect that when you quantize gravitons, right, you don't get any corrections to the GPU?
You will have radiative corrections, but they will contribute higher orders in H-bar. I'm talking about no longer needing to use the semi-classical limit, it's nowhere close to full quantum gravity. We're still thinking of matter fields as only distorting the space-time infinitesimally. But we are still nevertheless including gravitational fluctuations. That's what's not semi-classical about it. So we need this to be true in generic states, which is like a sort of gravitationally modified Anach, which has, and also has to be greater than zero to provide focusing, which one would hope to hold in generic states. So now can we prove this by the same argument? And we almost can. Everything I said up to the point of theta future greater than or equal to theta past still works. But now when we integrate the Reich-Dury equation, we get the theta future is this integral of the null energy and the shear square of the future horizon. And this is the null energy plus the shear square of the past horizon. I should point out that this statement is actually kind of different from the Anach, in that the Anach only needs us to specify a geodesic. But this sigma is assuming that the geodesic is part of the causal surface, and it depends on the local properties of the causal surface. So we get this, and this is the shear square of the future horizon, and this is the shear square of the past horizon. That is the only obstruction, the only major obstruction to getting a modified form of the Anach here. To get the shear inclusive Anach, we have to assume that the shear of the past and future horizons is the same at order h bar to the 1/2. In other words, well, not quite in other words, but this would follow if the horizons don't separate to h bar to the 1/2 order. So matter fields separate the horizons by h bar. This is saying gravitons would do the same thing. They would only separate it to h bar. I haven't been able to prove this in general, but I have been able to show it for non-extremal black holes and for PP wave spacetimes. So, and I expect this to be generally true. So this really amounts to a classical question about how classical spacetimes with horizons behave under small perturbations. And the thesis, the statement is that to linearized order, they don't separate. They only separate to quadratic order. And it's true in the cases I've looked at, which are a broad range, leading me to think it's generally true. But this is a hole. But if we can plug that hole, then we get the shear inclusive Anach, which says that the null energy, including the shear square, has to be greater than or equal to zero. Then, in order to get the result, we need to generalize the theorem of Penrose, Sorkin, and Woolgar, and of Graham and Olin to get all the nice things I've said. All we have to do is argue that this equality doesn't hold generically. And presumably the GSL can integral, presumably the GSL inequality can only be saturated in non-generic states. I would expect in a generic state, you just send in a little bit of extra energy in the far future of the horizon, and it should lead to the horizon having increasing area. So I would expect the GSL only is an equality in non-generic states. So I would expect this is that would work. And my conclusions. If the GSL is true, and CPT, and cosmic censorship, and all the other nuances that you should really read my paper for. Then the annex holds on no lines to this order and perturbation theory, to the leading order. Therefore, the GSL prohibits negative mass objects, traversable wormholes, and closed time-like curves. It might be interesting to try to prove these things directly from the GSL without the intermediary of the ANEC. I'm sort of inclined to view this as saying the GSL is really more fundamental. That's the thing that holds in generic states. The ANEC is sort of only a consequence. Also, in order to be useful as an energy condition, the shear squared term has to be added to the ANEC whenever you have a situation where you have gravitational fluctuations that have to be considered. Finally, in order to make this work, we need the GSL to be true for rapidly changing quantum fields. And this has not yet been proven semi-classically. So the premise has not been proven. I have a proof that I'm writing up right now that works for Rindler horizons, but I haven't been able to show it yet for more general horizons. So I'd like to prove it, but it's not clear whether the moral of this story is that we need to assume the achromal ANEC or we won't be able to prove the GSL, or maybe the moral of the story is that we can prove the GSL without that assumption, and then we get the achromal ANEC for free. I don't know which it is. But you don't need anything like the ANEC to prove the GSL for slow changes. So I'm suspecting it's the latter case. All right, that's all.
So any questions?
So if you did need the ANEC to prove the GSL, why would that be, or how would it feed into the proof?
I only have very speculative ideas about that. But in the case, for my proof for Rindler horizons, the reason I could prove it for Rindler horizons is that there's also a null translation symmetry. We spoke about that. So I was hoping that I was thinking it might be possible that the ANEC sort of gives good properties of the null translation, a sort of effective null translation symmetry, even in the case of a space-time that is not, that doesn't have a null translation killing vector, like the eternal black hole case. If we say that the stress energy in the Hardwick-Hawking state, the null stress energy tensor is exactly zero all along this horizon. So if it turns out that the ANEC is true for these lines, which are achromal, then that would mean, so if that holds for all states, then it should hold as an operator equation, which then means that the fact that the Hardwick-Hawking state has zero null energy along any one of its geodesics in horizon generators would hold as an operator equation, but that means that it's preserved by whatever symmetry is generated by the ANEC itself, which is a sort of a local translation along the horizon. So that was my idea, but I don't know whether it's any good or not. Yeah.
There's this whole technology developed about isolated horizons. Could you use that to maybe more localize this?
So let's see, an isolated horizon has to have no shear in it, right?
Well, I mean, there's a general set of conditions, but I might imagine that maybe you could show that GSL in regions where the isolated horizon criteria hold would mean ANEC would hold preferably.
Right, that may be the case.
Are you optimistic, pessimistic?
I need to look again at the exact definition of isolated horizon. But if it only involves the horizon. Does it imply that the horizon is stationary?
I think so. Yeah.
If so, then I think it's horizon.
There might be a generalized form.
If so, then I believe its horizon generators will have to be null lines. And then this would apply. So yes, I am optimistic.
So, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So you have this general, this new form of the anic.
Yes.
So can you just isolate that from the discussion and state what exactly what it demands? Does it apply to an arbitrary achronal null geodesic? Or do you need more? Or what exactly?
The idea would be anytime you have an achronal, anytime you have a null line lying on the horizon, that the local horizon, or actually nothing, I guess it only needs to be a causal surface. So anytime you have a null line lying on a causal surface so that the shear is defined, that equation should hold.
So that just means a null, a null surface?
Yeah, just a null surface. So anytime you have a null surface on which a null line lies, this equation should hold, except possibly with an equality. Or you want to keep looking at that. So you can think of this, I like to think of this as a gravitational null energy. Morally speaking, in many, this behaves a lot like a null energy for horizon thermodynamics. The weird thing is there's no gravity waves aren't described by any sort of local stress energy tensor in general. You only have a pseudo-tensor, so it's not a covariant notion, because you can transform it to flat to first order everywhere. But in some sense, by introducing the horizon here, we're adding enough extra structure that the notion becomes starts to make sense of the null flux across the horizon. So by taking a weird causal surface in Minkowski space, you could then see things like that there would be null gravitational energy even in Minkowski space.
There'd be non-zero.
Yeah, for some horizons, for some causal surfaces.
So this condition only applies to a stationary spacetime or some very special spacetime that have...
Only the background has to be special.
The perturbations, the background is stationary, shouldn't the perturbations be stationary?
No.
Well, okay, so you have quantum perturbations.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're
but
not...
You have to agree on your special class of metric perturbations.
No, not at least if we include the, if we have these gravitational fluctuations. Yeah, there's no special class other than the things I said that it's caused by, it has to be sourced by a sort of falling off sufficiently quickly matter
field. You're talking about quantum, not classical perturbations.
That's right.
So, okay.
These are quantum perturbations. And they can be quite general.
Why are they quantum perturbations?
Added a quantum field.
I understand, but I'm saying, why do they need to be small? I mean, what keeps them?
What's the limitation here?
Yeah.
Well, once they get big enough, then we have to start including these terms. So this theorem is good to h-bar. So once we start to have to worry about h-bar to the 3/4 terms, then it won't work. Now, I should point out that because the thing we're trying to prove is an inequality, so long as the first order terms dominate the later terms, that means we don't have to think about the later terms at all. And it can't be changed unless the earlier terms are zero. In which case you could worry about this being small and negative. But that generically doesn't happen. But once it gets big enough, you're going to have to go to all orders in H prime.
But I mean, I don't see where you do the truncation, because everything you've done was classical. So I mean, why aren't these just classical?
Not everything I've done is classical. I have a quantum field theory. I have a quantum field theory right here. And yeah.
But where did you use the fact that it's quantum?
Where did I use
it? Classical field theory.
If it were a classical one, then, I guess if you weak monotonicity should still hold for a classical field. So I suppose, that everything still works. I mean, you can think of a classical field as being a special case of a quantum field in which all observables commute. I guess the question is, yeah, that's probably the question. For a classical field, would we expect the GSL to hold? And maybe not. So it might be implicit in my assumption of the GSL.
Well, why not?
Well, because if you drop in stuff with entropy into a black hole, in various Gedanken experiments, where you try to throw in stuff that has a very large amount of entropy into the black hole to violate the GSL, the thing that stops it from happening is the fact that there's this thermal atmosphere that an observer hovering very close to the horizon sees, and that's a quantum effect. It's locally under radiation. So if that quantum effect is missing, but this whole thing has an H bar in it, so I mean there's an H bar in the formula here. So you could say if by classical you mean that H bar equals zero, then forget about the entropy, we just have the area increase theorem. Maybe that would give the annex for classical. But the area increase theorem itself implies the... Yeah, I guess you could say if you assume the area increase theorem, then you can prove that the classical fields satisfy the annex on null lines. That seems like an interesting result.
Okay, let us stop.
All right, thank you all for coming.